For those of you who were here last week, we talked about hope, first week of Advent, and we talked about having a vision of hope that was big enough, that wasn't just centered within our own small relationships or small walls, whether it's the walls of our house or the walls of this church, but that had a bigger scope that reached out further. And in fact, that vision that we heard last week was a vision of peace. That swords might be beat into plowshares and spears into pruning hooks, and that nations might no longer study war. A vision of peace, and here we are once again, presented with another reading from Isaiah, another vision for peace that we might hope for. One of the commentators that I read this week suggested that we think of this morning's reading as having two parts, like a diptych. You know, a diptych is one of those paintings with two panels, and they go together. And the first half of the reading is the first panel of the diptych and represents justice, that image of the anointed one, the ruler that would come and bring justice to the land. And the second panel of that diptych represents peace, what's sometimes called the peaceable kingdom, the image of the animals, the predators and prey, lying down together. And you'll notice in that second panel, that image of peace, that the big enough question goes even further. Is it just me, or am I ringing a lot? Yeah. Let's see if this is... Eventually you'll be able to hear me. Am I ringing any less? Yeah. No? Okay. I can't tell if I'm just hearing things weird because of my cold. All right. So that second image takes the big enough question even further, because now it's not just about all nations, all peoples, the way the Isaiah reading we heard last week was about, but now it's about all of creation. Animals lying down together, from lions and wolves and lambs to snakes, which in general don't have a good rep in the Bible. They're all hanging out together. That image of peace is something that extends beyond human bounds and encompasses all of creation. So that question of something being big enough, a vision being big enough, is pushed even further here. But what isn't very present in that second part of the diptych is adults. Adult human beings. You have animals and children being represented. And that's something for us to ponder. Why aren't adults there figuring out how to exist in peace? Is it because of how much we treasure the innocence and wonder of children? Is it because of our own suspicion of the violence that exists within each of us as adults? Does it make this image stronger or weaker that we, here, rather than the people downstairs, aren't present? So that diptych of justice and peace presents us with another vision. And last week I asked us, is our vision big enough? And this week I'll ask, how do we want to get there? And I won't answer that question. But maybe you will. How do we want to get there? How do we strive to reach that vision of peace? Now, who here has read The Year of the Flood by Margaret Atwood? Okay, most of you won't know what I'm talking about. Perfect. In The Year of the Flood by Margaret Atwood, she imagines a future that's very closely tied to the present. There's all sorts of different things, like the power of big corporations, the development of genetic engineering, not just with plants, but with animals as well. And there's the destruction of what they call the waterless flood, a plague that ends up wiping out a huge part of the human population of the world. It's a vision of everything that can and is going wrong. And there's a question to be asked about whether it's also a vision of hope. But there are a few points that jump out about that book for me, and part of it is because she very specifically talks about this passage that we hear today. This passage from Isaiah of the wolf and the lamb lying down together. Because in this world that she imagines, there are a couple of religious sects who are longing for this peaceable vision of the future, but don't agree. And those two groups are called the wolf Isaiahists and the lion Isaiahists, which isn't that easy to say. And they disagree about which animal is lying down with the lamb. Is it the wolves or is it the lions? Right? And this is an important theological and biblical question that has completely split these two religious groups, so that they are completely at odds. And they long for this vision of peace, this vision of the possible future, and are so caught up in the details of what it must look like that violence exists in its wake. Is it the wolf or the lion that lies down with the lamb? What are those important questions that we ask as we ask, how do we get there? And for them, it is an important question because it happens that with our advancements in bioengineering, at least within Atwood's novel, that it's possible to make sure the lion and the lamb do lie down together by creating a new creature that is a hybrid between the lion and the lamb, which is called a liobam, and is developed within this book. So that literally the lion and the lamb exist as one. And it has golden fur and it gambols in the fields and also has sharp fangs. That's the liobam. How do we want to get there? When we take these visions of peace, these visions of justice, it's quite easy to get caught up in the details. And although Atwood takes a satirical look at how this might appear, these kinds of questions or this kind of yearning, this kind of attempts to make something come true don't necessarily seem so distant, so impossible. Do we disagree about the kinds of outreach work we should be doing? Do we disagree about what the best way to resolve an issue peacefully is? Do we disagree about what point we start our work of peace and justice, and so caught up in that disagreement, not even begin? Or do we take things so literally, so within the box, that we find solutions that have nothing to do with the spirit of the task? Like the liobam, like the lion Isaiahists and the wolf Isaiahists, where do we get caught up in the details of what something has to look like? Where do we get caught up in the busyness of what we're doing so that we don't actually work towards that bigger vision? I wanted to spend one more minute with the Year of the Flood, because I was reading a review of this book by Ursula K. Le Guin. And in it, she wrote this: affection and loyalty are strongly felt. Loving relationships between characters are memorable. Such loyalties are affirmed, and of course, against all the odds. And like everything Toby, Wren, Amanda, and the gardeners are and do, will soon end in the brute failure of all human intentions. So that was a number of characters, and that reflects the way that despite all of their efforts, all the efforts of all these characters, the waterless flood, that plague comes, and things fall apart. But Le Guin continues, "Yet such loyalty sprang up like the shoots of March, in this tiny green featherweight in the scales of doom, we persist in seeing a vast, irrational hope. And somewhere here, somewhere in this irrational affirmation, I think, lies hidden the heart of the novel. Such loyalty spring up like the shoots of March. In this tiny green featherweight in the scales of doom, we persist in seeing a vast, irrational hope." And that is what this passage from Isaiah is about as well. That image of the stump of Jesse bringing forth a new shoot, a new branch, a new direction, a new possibility, simply new life. And it's a story for the writers about that continuation of the line of David, which was true at the time that Isaiah was living and became important to the gospel writers, who you'll notice that Matthew and Luke present genealogies for Jesus that prove that he was a descendant of David, at the same time suggesting that Joseph wasn't actually his father. But that's not important, because it's a story. And what's important is that he could be both at the same time, because it was important to be a continuation of this line. And the genealogies are different, by the way, but they both prove the same thing, that Jesus was from the stump of Jesse, because that fulfilled this prophecy. Because that way they could say, yes, look at Jesus as that fulfillment of this vision that we've been carrying for centuries. And they could see that promise of new life. They could take the same story and tell it and retell it to give it new meaning, just as we take the stories of our scripture and the stories of our other works and tell them and retell them, like Atwood, like we do here, to bring new meaning. So that shoot, that image of new life, that's a glimpse of the answer to the question of how do we get there? Not focusing on the details, not getting bogged down by the busyness, but leaving room for the unexpected, for the new possibilities, for the new life that might emerge. Given that it's our congregational vote after church today about coming together with Prestine Woodbine, it's an appropriate image. A new shoot. A new branch coming forth from what has existed, but not the same. Something new, unexpected, with new possibilities. And as individuals, we might ask the question as well, of where the stump is in our own lives. Our own hearts, that is waiting for that new shoot, where we might not expect new possibilities, but there is the room, there is the space where it is ready to grow. Where is that stump waiting for the new shoot to burst forth in our hearts? The new directions that are unexpected and yet ready to grow. It's a question that I asked last year at this time as I was looking for a new congregation to work with, and at many other times in my life as well. And that new life draws from where we've been and who we are, but it's not the same. It grows and develops in a new place, just as we hope to do as individuals, as a new congregation. And as part of this larger vision of all creation and all of the world. And one of the commentators asked, where can the lion and the lamb in your own self, in your own heart, lie down together? And isn't working towards that a better vision of the peaceable kingdom, of what might be, than those lion dams? I want to end with a quotation that comes from Dr. Brian Linard from A Way to the Heart of Christmas. So he writes, a noted poet was once asked in an interview if he could explain one of his poems in ordinary terms. He replied with some feeling, if I could say what I meant in ordinary terms, I would not have had to write the poem. From the time of Christ's birth, the people of God have had to write a poem to Christmas, composing a single, multi-stranded paean of praise spanning the centuries, because ultimately the meaning of Christmas resists being fully spelled out in ordinary terms. And so we come back to the poems. Poems like the one we read this morning from Isaiah. Poems like the hymns that we sing together, both modern and old. Poems like the ones that we write in our words and in our actions, knowing that this mystery of new life that springs forth for justice and peace, cannot be explained in ordinary terms, can only be painted through art and poetry and the beauty of our own lives. And for that, we give thanks. Amen.